When the art day gets rough, you just gotta keep on punching. And here's your Thunder Punch Daily with Jersey Drozd.
That almost sounds like she's proud of me, doesn't it? I love that introduction. Hey, it's me, Jersey, and it's time for your Thunder Punch Daily. 10 minutes or so of just thoughts from my workday and other things involving making comics and cartooning. I promise I'm going to work more on this intro. So what am I thinking about today? Well, I got a call from my little brother, Elliot, and he was calling me about the new U2 album, and I only say that just to explain why he called me, just telling me that it was really good and he enjoyed it and he wanted me to check it out. And he said there was a lyric in one of the songs that he really got a kick out of, and he said that the line ran something along the lines of, "Don't let your enemies define you, or choose your enemies carefully, lest they define you," or something to that effect. And it reminded me of something that I'm constantly thinking about in all the projects I work on, and what I'm thinking about when building characters and building conflict and building themes in my stories. I think about opposites, because a lot of the time, yeah, we are defined by our enemies or by what we dishonor or despise. That can be a really effective clue into telling your reader a little bit about this character. You express what they love and what they hate, right? And this kind of plays into building good character dynamics by thinking about opposites or foils, if you want to use that fancy term. Just to back up a little bit and talk about this point of how the opposite works, where it comes from. The psychologist Carl Jung, he wrote about a concept that he called the shadow. And after quickly looking on Wikipedia to make sure I could make my point properly, apparently has something to do with projecting our personal inferiorities into a perceived moral deficiency in someone else. In other words, and this is where I can paraphrase a little bit from Joseph Campbell, who is paraphrasing about the concept of the shadow. When you meet somebody and you instantly dislike them, it's usually because they have some aspect of their personality that represents things about you that you won't let yourself be. They're the you that you won't allow yourself to be. They represent, you know, traits and values that you dishonor or despise. So an enemy, an opponent, or opposite can reveal something about you, yourself, because, I mean, you may not even know that you dishonor or despise these things until you meet that person. And so, too, can you use those kinds of characters, pitting opposites against each other, to reveal a lot about the characters? I've often talked, I mean, at length in many episodes of Art and Story with Mark Rudolph about this concept of bold, vibrant characters and putting them in a room together and watch them scream at each other. That makes for good, entertaining storytelling as well as effective storytelling. Watching them bicker is going to tell us an awful lot about them. So let's talk about opposites attracting. And I'm going to have a little anecdote from my own work to back up this point. An opposite can also, a pair of opposites can also form unexpected relationships, because if your shadow is the you that you won't allow yourself to be, that implies that they're going to have abilities that you can't have because you won't allow yourself to explore that part of your personality, right? So that can actually be an attractive thing. I mean, that's an old expression, right? Opposites attract. But I think there's a little bit of a grain of truth in that. Like all platitudes, there's always a little grain of truth there, is that if you're attracted, a person who is able to do things that you are incapable of doing because you won't allow yourself to be that thing, they can become attractive to you. And then I've got a little anecdote of how I explored this concept of using opposite characters for effective storytelling with a comic that I did with Sarah Turner called The Replacements. You can find it at MLATcomics.com. It's right there on the main page. I don't know, it's a 170-page graphic novel. It's all there for free. So let's take Helen and Bruce, the two of the main characters in The Replacements. And I'm gonna oversimplify this a little bit, make this a little diagrammatic. And let me say really quickly that, just another disclaimer, this kind of diagrammatic thinking is only good for breaking it down to provide you with options when you're stuck on an idea. This true creativity happens. Like in the case of The Replacements, this is a story that Sarah and I wrote almost entirely off the cuff, and we were discovering the characters as we worked on them. So this wasn't this kind of prearranged recipe, kind of roadmappy thing. As a matter of fact, now that I use the term roadmappy, I'm going to invoke some of the words of Ron Friedman.
Now, if this sounds like an interchangeable part kind of roadmappy way to write, I got to tell you now, there are no roadmaps to writing. And all of the books on how to write your screenplay and live in the south of France forever can best be summed up in a book that was written several years ago. It's called $10,000 a Week for 10 Weeks Every 15 Years. That's the writer's lot. So the trick is to find a way to do it on demand, on command, and do it at a certain level of proficiency and excellence. And there are no rules for that. If there were, every one of these Learn to Be a Writer seminars and all of the books that accompany them would have produced a generation of brilliance so that we would not now turn on television and say, who put this crap on? Or look at the movie guides and say, there's nothing there I want to see. So it's called, it's a process and it's a difficult one.
Yeah, there we go. So It's not a guaranteed recipe for success, but thinking about this stuff can provide you with extra tools for when you're stuck. So looking back after the fact at The Replacements, here's some of the things that Sarah and I were doing with the characters. And the interesting thing, too, is that in this case, I created the character Helen, Sarah created the character Bruce, and it was through our dialogue between each other and through with the work that we found these things about using opposites. So with Helen, Helen is a museum registrar. I specifically chose that job because that's a job where a person works behind the scenes. They're cataloging, they're organizing. This isn't a job for somebody who is overtly passionate. You know, I mean, there's different kinds of passion, of course. I mean, she's passionate about what? She's passionate about boxing things, ordering things, putting things in their place. And she is not a person who likes to be the public face of something. She doesn't like interacting with people. And we took care in the beginning of the graphic novel to express that she doesn't get along with people very well. She doesn't like interacting with people. She has a streak of arrogance about her. She thinks she's the smartest person in the room, but she doesn't like to make a lot of noise about it. She just feels like a sort of a quiet satisfaction in that. She's somebody who values reason and order and calmness. Why? Well, that was another thing we introduced into her character, is that she's prone to panic. She is not very adept at expressing her emotions well. And as a result, she when she does have to experience any kind of emotional high or low, it's out of her control. And we express that physically through the bracelet that she wears on her hand that responds to her emotional state, sort of like a mood ring on her wrist that summons monsters based on her emotional state. And what better way to have her inadvertently use the thing and get the ball rolling with the story than to have her be an emotional basket case when she's not fully in control of the situation? She's prone to panic, and we express that visually in a scene where, when she can't remove the bracelet, she has this daydream about being put in a museum jail, and everybody's clicking their tongues at her, like, oh, she's still company property. What a bad person! And she's screaming through the bars, "Let me out!" You know. She's apt to think the worst of a situation. She's a cynic. Now, conversely, there's Bruce. Now, Bruce is a drifting 1950s greaser. He rides a motorcycle. That kind of goes with the package of being a 50s greaser, but just the act of riding a motorcycle suggests that you are a person who is more at ease with being around people and being seen, being visible. And Bruce is a guy who, he likes to throw his ego around a little bit. He likes the accolades and the attention that being a hero grants him. And we express that even in his, he has a similar daydream in the first chapter of the book where he's rushing to save rushing to attend to a burning building, and he has this daydream about saving babies from an orphanage, and he's screaming, "Here are your babies," and there's all these women grabbing his, you know, like laying about his feet, saying, "My hero." You know, so that tells you a lot of what you need to know about this. That's his fantasy. Helen's fantasy is being thrown in the museum jail. Bruce's fantasy is being a hero for all the attractive ladies. But what's his weakness? He secretly doubts his own intelligence. He's optimistic, but he doesn't think of himself as the smartest man in the room. So now we've got a pair of opposites. Helen is introverted. She's cynical. She's very intelligent and respects intelligence, reason, and order. Bruce is a little bit more chaotic, optimistic, outgoing, bombastic, but he doesn't necessarily look at his intelligence as his chief commodity in life, right? So now that we've got those two opposites together, of course they're not going to get along, and that kind of conflict makes for interesting storytelling. What Helen responds to in Bruce and what she gets aggravated about his what he considers to be his positive traits are things that she dishonors, despises. So she thinks he's foolish. She thinks that he's gullible and even childish. On the other hand, he looks at her as this ice queen, and what's more is that she can't even, you know, she doesn't even have the emotional wherewithal to, like, control her emotions like he can. He's courageous. He leaps into battle, and he embraces his emotions while she fears her emotions. And that creates, again, it starts out with them being at each other's throats as they're sort of tied into this situation where neither of them can escape, and they have to work together. But it also creates a bit of a friendship because there's a couple moments in the story where they actually express admiration for one another. But it's usually when one of the characters is experiencing either a physical or emotional crisis in the story, and then the other character, the other opposite, kind of comes in to fill in the gap. So, case in point, remembering that Helen's strength is reason, logic, and order, and Bruce's strength is courage and optimism and dynamism. Bruce meets, in the third chapter of the book, he meets his lifelong hero, Chase Magnanimous. And I won't go into too much detail for people who are worried about spoilers, but it's a very disappointing experience. It's a crushing experience. It's one of those things where you meet your hero and he's a jerk. And Bruce doesn't know how to deal with it. For the first time in his life, he's speechless. He walks out of the room silently and goes and sits down on the curb. And we even took care to, like, throughout the story, Bruce smokes cigarettes and part of his cool guy image. And he sits down, he lights a cigarette, and then takes a look at it and just throws it away. He doesn't even have the emotional energy to act cool right now. He's just wrecked. Helen sits down next to him, and she gives him a little speech about something she learned about the arts, being a museum registrar. And in effect, her little speech builds him back up. Why? Because she is a reasoning character. She's a calm character. And so she fills in where he can't. He doesn't have the intellectual wherewithal to parse through that moment and figure out what that moment meant to him. So that's where the opposites can be a benefit to one another and support one another. Conversely, there's another scene in the book where Helen is being duped by August Snide, the villain of the story, and she doesn't realize it, but he's about to, he plays to her selfishness and her cynicism to strike a deal with her to get the crazy monster bracelet back. And she buys into it because she, you know, believes in the bargaining of a good deal. Because she is a cynic after all. This guy can't be, whether or not he's good or bad is irrelevant. If he's going to offer her a good deal to get out of this mess that she's in with this bracelet and all, she'll take it. Bruce comes in and immediately attacks August Knight and sends him away and relieved her from physical danger because of his overabundance of heroic optimism and believing that and understanding that in his heart, not his mind, that this guy's a bad guy no matter what he's promising. But in both cases, the moment the crisis, the emotional or physical crisis is over, what do these two characters do? They immediately start bickering again. Because when they're at rest, when they're at ease, they should always be at each other's throats because, you know, you've ever heard the expression, familiarity breeds contempt and all that. And being around people who are your opposites when you're relaxed is an annoyance. They're only good to have around when there's a crisis. And they understand that they're friends throughout the story, but they're always going to argue with one another because the differences are so extreme in the characters. So there's a few ruminations today about using opposites in your stories. I got a feeling this is going to be a multi-parter. I'm going to come back to this using opposites and foils in stories because this is just one way to do it. I mean, you can build thematic opposites. You can create opposites to express different sort of points in your story, points of view of your story, reflecting two different inflections of the same point in your story. There's a lot to talk about here when using opposites in your storytelling and how you can create an ensemble cast where they're all different kinds of opposites from one another. I'm already going long on this episode. That's proof positive that there's a lot to cover here. So I'm going to save the rest for some other segments. So, yes, opposites. Think about what makes your characters different from one another, and those differences are going to bring out a lot between them in your stories. So who am I? I'm Jersey Droz of jdroz.com. ArtandStoryPodcast.com is where you can find the other shows that we do, like Mark Rudolph's Mark of the Beast, Kevin Cross's High Adventure Daily, our extra episodes of Art and Story Extreme, Art and Story Supreme, our monthly show just for you, the wonderful art and storyer who subscribed to this content. Don't forget about the forums. You can discuss this stuff in the Art and Story forums. That's at cvcomics.com/artandstory/forum. The login that you got for the Supreme content is the same login that you can use to get into the forums, and you can discuss this stuff there and talk with us. Talk to us in the special safe place for only for the art and storyers. So thank you for listening. Oh, the music was by my brother, Elliot Droz. The voiceover was by Tara Platt of TaraPlatt.com. I appreciate their work to make this show that much better. It's probably the best part of the show is the intro. So thanks for listening, everybody. And remember,
being the most powerful man in the universe isn't all that makes He-Man such a great hero. Being strong is fine, but there's something even better. In today's story, He-Man used something even more powerful than his muscles to beat Skeletor. You know what it was? If you said his brain, you were right. And just like a muscle, your brain is something you can develop to give yourself great power.